I would like to describe a field in which little has been done, but in which an enormous amount can be done. This field is not quite the same as the others in that it will tell us little of fundamental physics, but it will tell us much about the strange phenomena that occur just below our perception. In contrast to the natural philosophers of the past, the scientists of this field delve into the recesses of nature and show how she works in her hiding places. Their quest is to understand and create the imperceptible. After all, there is plenty of room at the bottom.
Hello and welcome to the Materialism Podcast, an exploration of the past, present, and future of material science and engineering. My name is Taylor Sparks. I am a professor of material science and engineering at the University of Utah, and I am joined by my co-host and graduate student, Andrew Falkowski. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm really excited for this episode.
Well, I'm excited today, Andrew, because we're going to talk about a new paper from Microsoft. Now, there's a lot of discussion about accelerating materials twice as fast at a fraction of the cost, the whole MGI premise. But what I see in the literature is a lot of predictions because the actual experimentation is hard to do. And I am pumped today because here we see both sides of it. We're going to see a really cool approach to predicting new materials, and they're going to follow through and actually make some of those things. And I would tell you about it, but even better, we've got some of the authors here with us. So we are joined by Nathan Baker and Shi Chen to talk about this really cool approach from Microsoft Azure. Guys, want to do a brief introduction?
Yep. My name is Shi Chen. I'm a principal quantum engineering manager at Microsoft in the Azure Quantum Elements team. I lead a team of scientists and engineers that work on the material science and AI related products. I've been a long-term fan for Materialism podcast. I'm super excited to be here.
Thanks, Shi.
My name is Nathan Baker. I am the product lead for Azure Quantum Elements and also a longtime fan of Materialism. Although I'm a chemist and I'm not sure if those are allowed on the podcast. Thanks for making an exception.
Absolutely. We love chemists. In fact, we just found out that in January, we hit the number one spot in the chemistry category of iTunes, which feels like such a coup to me. I'm just so happy about it. So we want to keep it up. We love our chemist buddies. Yeah, thanks. And I've known Chi since 2018 or something. We invited him to speak at a workshop and I've admired his work ever since. So I'm just delighted to have this team here to talk about a really cool episode. Maybe to kick it off, before we get into what you guys did, I'm really excited because when I look around the field of material science right now, especially in informatics area, there's been this incredible growth of new digital tools and guides, which is, I think, changing the way that we do physical sciences. So my question to you is, is the role of material scientists changing with this onset of digital tools?
Definitely. I think we all know that computational materials design has been a really hot topic during the past few decades. There has been, I know in one of your episodes, you talk about the SAME, which I really loved. And obviously, in the past decades, we see a material genome initiative, things like Materials Project, OQMD, Aflow, and all those databases. They really created a very nice foundation for all the data that we can be available for material science. And people have developed many tools, including machine learning models. Those include the tools that I developed to try to help people further accelerate the process of computational material discovery. I personally really think that those tools are really necessary. And going forward, I see a big role of how AI could help us shape the future of further acceleration and automation of material discovery. Definitely, those tools are needed.
Totally agree. Nathan, is it the same in chemistry? Are they just as welcoming of this sort of digital revolution, or is there more holdouts? What do you think?
Well, that's a loaded question. Yeah, I think that, the advent of AI and HPC is equally scary and exciting, I think, to everyone. We know it's going to change the way we do science. Change can be scary, but that acceleration should really just be thrilling to anybody who is, has spent time waiting for a simulation to finish.
Oh, yeah.
Realizing they never hit the time scale needed to explore a specific phenomenon. It's a game changer in a good way. And really, like we'll talk about in a bit here, a lot of what it's doing is just taking traditional pieces of a simulation workflow and speeding them up by orders of magnitude. So the concepts haven't changed. The underlying approach hasn't changed. We're just making it easier to get to a solution more quickly.
Yeah, and when I look at the overall field of material science, one of the trends that I see is that I think the intersection of the two, of computational and physical side, seems to be happening more frequently, right? Rather than there being these kind of discrete units of people who do the computational work, and then they give some feedback to the physical and vice versa. It seems that that's happening simultaneously and in joint with many people kind of having skill sets now in both. And that seems to be kind of the trend as well. It's not just, you know, doing the physical side of things, like the having that computational background or the ability to engage with computational tools seems more necessary than ever.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And in some sense, we need to meet in the middle, right?
Oh, yeah.
We need to increase everyone's knowledge of how computation works and what it can do. But we also need to make the tools more usable, more accessible, and, you know, kind of democratize the process of computational material science or computational chemistry.
Definitely. I think one of the hardest things is knowing what I want to do, but then having to learn the software to actually do it, which is sometimes non-trivial. You have to read through the documentation, and every software does it differently based on who made it. And sometimes that can be the limiting factor, is how accessible those tools are.
Yeah, I think Chi recognized that early on. We've been spending a lot of effort building out Copilot types of interfaces to drive simulation. And Chi, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about how you thought about reducing the barriers to putting all the tools together.
Yeah, that's actually something I've given a lot of thought on. I've talked to some of my colleagues, some other researchers, and looking back, what are kind of things, kind of research that I did in the past that brought the most impact. So I've never published a Nature paper or a Science paper. If I look at the top cited papers from my past, those are the ones that I developed also our software package, yep, that people can 100%. Use. Things like this distributed relaxation times, and also things like MagNet or M3GNet. Those are things we try to develop a software that are so easy to use that people can just install with just one click, and they can run the software with just one line of code. Those really helped. And I try to bring the same kind of thought to Microsoft. So as Nathan mentioned, we try to build the Copilot, which is really something I feel super passionate about, because you can leverage the large language model and your like text input to ask a system so complicated to help you perform the task without even touching this code, without even writing one line of code. That makes me feel super excited. For the Copilot that we're developing, so far, as you probably see in the quantummicrosoft.com, there has been some unique capabilities that you can talk to a large corpus of data, like text data. You can ask the Copilot to summarize
what
it has. And you can also ask the Copilot to query a database for you, so you don't have to remember all the syntax to do a SQL query or any MongoDB query. Those Copilot can help you write that part and then return the results to you and help you render those results. You could also ask the Copilot to trigger some calculations for you. If the user, some of the audience can sign up to our products, you can see that there is an improved version of the Copilot that works on the Azure Quantum Elements platform. You can ask the Copilot to help you write some code that can help you submit a job.
Yeah. We could do a whole episode, on how LLMs are creating interfaces. We probably will at some point. But that said, to bring it back to today's episode, I'm really curious, and I'm guessing many of our listeners are as well, to hear that Microsoft is working in this area of accelerated materials discovery. That may be surprising. Can you tell us why is Microsoft sort of interested in this area?
Sure. Yeah, it is a great question. I mean, if you think about what ingredients do you need to accelerate computational science, and in particular, computational materials discovery or chemistry, it's really about speeding up the underlying simulations and having ways to, you know, more quickly orchestrate the tools and workflows needed to solve a science problem. How do you do that? HPC and AI. And that's what Microsoft's been very focused on, right? Leadership in HPC in the cloud, high-performance computing in the cloud to make the physics simulations as efficient as possible, but also leadership in AI. Not only AI models that help accelerate parts of the pipeline, possibly replacing some simulations, but also AI models that help you orchestrate those tools, drive them with natural language, and just make it easier for people to do science rather than worrying about the syntax of an individual code.
So what I'm hearing is, like, even though the application is material science, the stuff in the back end, that's stuff that Microsoft is already doing and doing well. And so it was a natural demonstration to point it at materials discoveries. Okay, so before we get into the nitty-gritty details, maybe Shi, could you give us this a high-level overview of what you guys have tried to accomplish in this first sort of foray into combining Microsoft skill set towards materials research?
That's a great question. I think Nathan already gave a very good overview of why Microsoft is doing this. And obviously, we try to use AI and HPC, the cloud computing, to help to see how we can change the paradigm of how we can do science. One of the things that we saw in the community is really that many of the work actually focus on only computational discovery without going into making these things real. So the overall idea for the paper was that we try to see how we can leverage the Microsoft capability, those cloud computing AI, to accelerate the discovery, computation discovery of a new material. And then we try to see how we can bring this all the way to an actual physical product.
So you mentioned the idea of generating new materials and then using these ML and HPC pipelines to identify which ones are promising candidates and eventually make them. How did you go about generating new materials? What does that necessarily look like?
For the specific approach that we are looking at is based on taking existing known database, the so-called inorganic crystal structure database. Those basically are curated crystal structures that people have been doing for the past decades. But if you look at the database, I know you guys must be very familiar with, those contains about 200,000 crystal structures. So we take those structures, we identify those framework or the so-called prototype structures, and then we try to populate those prototypes with different elements, different combination of elements, making sure that those combination will give you the most physical structures. That means usually the charge has to be neutral. You do not have very outrageous things like you have an electronegative element to be the cation. Uh-huh. So we want to make sure that those will not happen. So it's a combinatorial brute force approach, if you would say, but still under the constraint of some physical constraints.
So brute force in that you're generating many candidates by starting with prototypes and you're decorating them with different combinations of atoms that should be at least feasible. You're not going to have any noble gas oxides. Yep. What sort of tools do you use to make sure that you're not violating, say, electron counting and things like that?
So on the one side, we try to put constraint on it. On the other side, we try to be more open.
Oh, yeah.
So
yep.
Some of the constraints we choose not to really impose into the candidate generation, so that we can get combinatorially as many candidates as possible to begin with. But we still have the subsequent steps that try to filter based on various properties. So in the scenario that you talk about, it's sort of implicit in the whole pipeline, because if some unrealistic candidates were generated, it can be easily filtered out in some of the energy calculations, stability calculations, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a smart move, because there's a lot of interesting materials. Well, first off, generating the candidates costs you almost nothing. That's very cheap.
Yeah.
The energy filtering, if you can leverage things like M3GNet, right? They do a really good job of filtering by energy in an also low-cost way. So you can get you can sort of have your cake and eat it too. You can explore wide breadth, and then you can throw out the ones that you don't think are realistic.
And about how many materials did you generate via this method?
So for this batch, we generated 32.6 million.
Wow.
I think we can generate way more, but that will be a future study.
Did you look at all possible prototypes, or did you stick to just, because, you know, I've looked at these data sets too. And for example, if you look at, in one data set that I looked at, there was 25,000 entries. And in those 25,000 formulas, there was 10,000 unique structures. But some of those structures had like thousands of formulas that corresponded to that structure, things that you've heard of, rock salt, spinel, perovskites, those are common. There's lots of examples. But about the one in the data set I looked at, about 70% of the entries had a single chemistry that existed with them. So I was curious, did you try like all possible prototypes, or did you just stick to the more common ones?
We tried all the possible prototypes. And we are not, so in the method we are doing, we are not really limiting ourselves to the well-known so-called prototype that you may see in databases like Aflow. We are basically taking all those structures and trying to do a structural match of each of the crystal framework and identify those ones that are relatively unique compared to the others. So this is our definition of a prototype instead of a conventional, like rock salt, perovskite, etc. So this way we can generate lots of prototype structures. And in our case, we have I think more than 10,000 prototypes, and this number will be growing in the future. We are still in the process of doing more.
I'm curious, do you quantify similarity between the structures? This is something that Andrew and I are working on right now, actually. So it's a topic of interest because some structures are more similar or more dissimilar from one another. And you could imagine that if you're going to spend your time, maybe you'd want to spread out your candidate generation across an equal dissimilarity between all of them. But I think it's not obvious how you'd go about doing that.
That's a very big topic for measuring the similarity between the structures. In the past, we have done things like using our neural network to get embedding of the structure, and then you can compare.
Oh, that's a good idea. Like take the latent space, like for example, take like a VAE embedding and compare that latent space.
Yes.
What a cool idea.
There are also some other methods like the SOAP descriptors where you can compute this matching between the descriptors, the similar ideas. But in our case, we are just looking at the crystal structure similarity by matching the positions of the atoms.
Okay.
By having a loose criteria, loose threshold for the angles and the distances, and we can sort of tell you, okay, those two crystal framework seems to be similar.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's the method we use. It's like a binary true or false kind of a situation.
Okay, so you've generated your candidates, you generated a lot, and I think casting a wide net makes a lot of sense. I did quite a bit of work on materials discovery for my master's, and I found similar results where if you constrict yourself too early, it can limit what you're actually going to find. And if you're interested in finding exotic things that people haven't found before, you might want to relax some of your restrictions or biases you might bring in as a physical chemist. But the next question is, you have 32 million. How do you get this down to one or a few candidates? Can you walk us through some of the filtering pipeline that you put together for this?
Yes, absolutely. So we start with this huge number of candidates. And then as a material scientist myself, I think the first things that we should do is always check whether this is feasible, right? Whether a material can be made, whether it's thermodynamically stable. If things cannot be stable, then it doesn't make sense to further optimize for any properties. So that's the number one filter that we used. As Taylor mentioned, that things like M3GNet can give you very fast energy calculation. You can find the ground state fairly quickly, and then you can compare this energy with respect to the other materials in the same chemical space. In this way, you know whether a material will be spontaneously decomposed into all other candidates. And once we have that information, we can proceed with the materials that are considered to be thermodynamically stable. We have about 500,000 of those candidates. And afterwards, we have those candidates and we think about what can we do with those candidates, right? One of the application domain that I'm familiar with and also of great interest to the society is of course the lithium battery applications. So then we decided to pivot towards that direction. We look into literature, find a few property matrix that people use, and then we either compute those properties for all the candidates or train a machine learning model to help us quickly predict those properties within less than a second for each of the candidates. We have properties like a band gap. That's a typical filter that we apply for if we are aiming for some insulators. In this case, we are looking for the lithium electrolytes. We want it to be electronic insulating, but ionically conducting, right? And we also optimize for things like a redox potential of this candidates compared to lithium. So that we know it will not get reduced or oxidized when it's working as in a battery. We also calculate things like lithium conductivity. We filter based on those properties. So there are definitely a lot more in that. We have a detailed list in the paper.
I'm looking at the figure right now. It's cool. Yeah. You basically like it. So if it's going to be lithium ion conductor, your first criteria is like, it's got to have lithium, right? Lithium's got to be in the structure in some amount, right? Over the 0.1 mole fraction, for example. But then you've got other things, right? Because I think you're really smart to identify that stability is a big one, right? But then you've got all these physical properties that matter. And so you can kind of go down the list. You can say, like, does it have a band gap that is greater than 3 EV? Yes or no, right? The reduction oxidation potentials, right? Then you can look at stability. And then you've got your MD diffusivity, right? So you're not just relying on DFT data. Now you're pointing your tools towards MD tools, which is awesome to see, to get an idea of, okay, it's got lithium, it's stable, it's got the right band gap. How quickly will the lithium ions move through it? And you go down and down, and eventually you're getting to more practical things like cost or mechanical properties or density. I like that, because what I've seen in the literature is way simpler versions of that. This is a much more complex pipeline that you've built up, where you're not just caring about a single property, which is sort of trivial. You're doing a true multi-objective consideration and using those in the filtering process, which is slick.
That's actually a great comment. So far, obviously, those are many of the filters that are choosing based on domain expertise. Going forward, we do hope to leverage the power of large language model. We have our Copilot in particular to help us find those filters in a field that is less studied.
Yeah, and maybe not having to leverage doing like MD simulations or as many DFT calculations. Maybe there is information encoded in the corpus of, you know, literature out there that you could use as a filter. What a brave world.
Yeah, if you look at how the two approaches played out in this one, the way we used AI in this study was really broadening the top of the funnel. You know, if you wanted to look at 32.6 million candidates using those traditional physics-based approaches, you would have been spending about, you know, 20 years running HPC simulations. And what AI allowed us to do was really focus in on the most promising candidates, get it down to, you know, maybe 800 or so very, very quickly, and then spend those time-intensive physics calculations focused on only the most promising. So if you think of the whole thing as a funnel, AI allows you to take the top of the funnel and really stretch it out and still, you know, have high throughput, get results very quickly. And so it's a very nice combination, having AI to screen quickly and then still get that deep insight and the, you know, the trustworthiness, if you will, from traditional physics-based DFT and MD simulations at the, for the lead compounds.
Yeah, really smart to take this, you know, large volume, but cheap evaluation. And then as you move towards smaller volumes, you're willing to invest more in more expensive, say, for example, MD versus DFT simulations. Super
cool. And eventually experiment, right? Somebody makes it. So,
well, one thing I was going to ask is, okay, so you're filtering this. You said it would take 20 years if we did this, trying to do this with a physical computation from the start, but we filtered it down. How long did it take to execute this whole pipeline on the computational side?
The total computational time is, if I remember correctly, is less than a week. So the number you see is 80 hours. That being said, we have access to about 1,000 virtual machines on the Azure cloud, so we can leverage this power to speed up the whole calculation pipeline.
For our listeners that aren't maybe familiar with doing these types of calculations, that's completely bonkers, what she just said. The compute resources and the way that you've architected this to go through that level of screening in a week, basically, is completely nuts. Like, that is really, really an impressive accomplishment.
But that's, you know, we wanted to illustrate from the start what happens when you take AI, you know, to accelerate this, and then HPC in the cloud at scale. And what's the impact if you put these two things together? So that was the exciting outcome we were driving for, was to show that you can take 20 years of compute and compress it down into 80 hours or a week.
Okay. So we're going to talk about synthesis in a moment. Like, ultimately, you're going to end up with some cool candidates and you're going to actually try and cook them up and see how they actually perform. But before we do that, along the way, you've generated an enormous amount of data. What are you going to do with that? Like, does that go somewhere? Like, what do you think is the opportunity with the generated data that wasn't even the winning candidates?
That's a great question. We also been thinking about this quite a lot. So, you know, when we started this this project, the initial step is really agnostic towards applications, right? You are looking at just some of the dynamic properties. And then we decide to pivot to one application. Very naturally, one can think about is to see how we can use those data towards a different application. That's a possibility. And it's, to me, I'm very optimistic that some interesting new things that we are going to find and discover in those data.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, because as you start to filter through large numbers of candidates, and then you get down to the most promising ones, you know, and let's say the most stable ones or the ones with particular redox properties, now you're investing in higher quality calculations and you're building up your data set. In many ways, this process is a flywheel, and it's a data flywheel. As we use AI to filter down and focus on the most promising candidates, we then follow up with, you know, physics-based simulations and ultimately physical characterization of those. And you're just increasing the depth of knowledge across this. That's knowledge that, you know, is important for the candidates that you find that become good electrolytes. It's also just important for training better models in the future.
Completely agree. Maybe before we move to synthesis, one last question I've got on this topic is, okay, you're building out cool tools. And first off, huge applause from us that you're making them publicly available. That is amazing. And we love it. So the tools themselves are available. What about the compute? Is Microsoft Azure Quantum aiming to make the compute resources also available? Is this something that is on a specific partnership basis, or what is that going to look like?
So there's a variety of ways that interested researchers can access the tools. So, as you mentioned, we make them all available through Microsoft Azure, the AI models, the HPC models, and even access to, you know, emerging quantum hardware is all possible through the cloud. Microsoft's also been a strong supporter of NAIR, the National Artificial Intelligence Research Resource. And that's another way that academic researchers and others can get access to, you know, the fairly exotic GPU and CPU hardware needed to drive some of these simulations. So there's the usual commercial route to accessing these, as well as these national resources like NAIR.
Awesome.
And I think that's really cool that it's these sorts of tools are coming online and becoming available, because I think there's a lot of need or desire within industry to leverage these tools to try to advance their materials discovery campaigns. But the resources you need from just a computing standpoint and the knowledge you need to execute on this can be pretty difficult. I don't think a lot of materials focused companies have that sort of specialization among their employees. And so having this tool available and taking steps to make it more accessible as well, I think will just open up new opportunities for materials discovery that's guided or enhanced through artificial intelligence and HPC. But maybe now to just pivot a little bit to the material that you actually made. So not only did you filter through this candidate list and find a number of promising candidates, but you actually went the next step and synthesized some of them. Can you tell us a little bit about the material that you synthesized, its properties, and what was surprising about it?
Yeah, as we started going through the list of candidates that were coming from Qi's pipeline, we got excited for a couple of reasons. One, several of the candidates that were showing up were known good solid-state electrolytes. So we knew we were on the right track. And once we knew we were on the right track, the question is, well, what should we do with these other materials? Qi is a material science expert, but we knew at some point we wanted to make these things. So we turned to our friends across the mountains on the east side of the state at Pacific Northwest National Lab, where there's a huge amount of expertise in the basic chemistry and material science of battery compounds. And we pulled them in and started asking them, what do you think of these results? And you know, what else would you like to see? They contributed some additional filters that went into the pipeline, ways to think about what makes a good electrolyte. But maybe most importantly, they said, yes, I think some of these should be synthesized and should be characterized. And that's what led to the next step.
Okay, so you've gone through the effort of identifying some interesting compounds. You've already gone through the screening process as we think these things are feasible. So you hope that somebody can actually make them in the lab. When you turn this list over to them and they picked some out, were they successful? Could they make some of these things?
Yes. We give our partner a few candidates, and one of the candidates shows very early promise that our partner actually made it. And we decided to focus on that one for the first study.
And properties, did it have, so you're able to make it, you're able to synthesize it and characterize the structure. I presume it had the same structure that you predicted it would have when you picked that chemistry. Did it match the structure that you were predicting that it would have?
I can see on the X-ray diffraction, yes, the patterns match for exactly the coordinates and all that. So that we will need for the study
Verify
that.
I assume you're doing powder diffraction, not single crystal at this point. Yes. Okay, so it's got you think the right structure, it so you can make it. Maybe tell us what the chemistry was.
The chemistry was the sodium, lithium, yttrium, chloride chemical space. So we have a mixture of all those interesting elements. And there are also previous studies that have shown some successes in the lithium compounds. And our work was like a step forward towards that direction.
Yeah, I'm looking at the formula. Na2Li yttrium chlorine 6. That is not something I would have picked. Like, it's got lithium, but the fact that sodium's also there is a bit unusual. The fact that it's a chloride and that yttrium, that is unusual. Maybe there's one potential upside here is that by having cation mixing on multiple different cations, you're increasing the disorder. And there's been quite a bit of research lately showing that additional disorder there can make the energy landscape a little flatter, making it easier to hop from site to site. So I guess it makes sense, but non-intuitive pick for the chemistry here.
I think that's one of the exciting things about this sort of broad search, right? You can use AI to accelerate the pipeline and look through many more candidates. You expect to turn up these non-intuitive results that can be exciting lead compounds in the future.
So did you have your friends at PNNL measure the things like ionic conductivity or stability against different redox conditions? What sort of other characterization did you employ?
First of all, we have X-ray diffraction patterns.
Uh-huh.
And they also measure the elemental ratios between all those different elements, making sure that we actually get the compounds that we think we will have.
Okay.
And we also measured the conductivity, as you mentioned. And we believe so far the properties are great as a starting point that we can further optimize at this moment.
Yeah, that's, because I do materials informatics, a lot of times we use materials informatics to point us in the right direction, but it's not meant to sort of replace the traditional approach. Like once you find, once that dog's got the bone, you can continue chasing down all the additional studies that you would normally do. And it looks like you're going to do it. Is Microsoft going to be interested in that aspect of it? Or at this point, are you sort of like, your end was the filtering pipeline and then pass it off to other interested parties?
Well, the point of the study was definitely to demonstrate the pipeline and demonstrate the speed up that combination of AI and HPC could give. But I mean, we're scientists, we're curious. We absolutely want to see what happens next, see how this thing works, understand the mechanistic details. But no, I don't think we're going to turn into a battery company. We want to see this to the end and understand how it works. And we also want to look for partners who can take this and, move it into real world applications. So we'll stick around for the curiosity and for the value of the material. But we're excited already about what we've seen on the computational side.
Cool.
And I think it's a great demonstration. And I really appreciate the thoroughness from an experimental side in terms of investigating the material that was found. And I think Taylor makes a great point as well about how, many of the materials that we use and are at sort of the cutting edge in terms of performance have had decades of development, even after their initial discovery, to get the stoichiometry correct, the processing correct. And so I think sometimes we can go in with a little bit of an unrealistic expectation for what finding a new material means. It's not going to already be this sort of panacea for a given application at its initial finding. But I think this demonstration shows the power of these tools for shining a spotlight in the right direction.
So this is an awesome case study. You've done a really good demonstration, I think, and I think it's no wonder that this is such a big paper and we're hearing so much about it. But I'm curious about what comes next, right? Like, where are you going next with this sort of approach?
That's a great question. So we're absolutely excited about the underlying computational methods. They'll continue to be an area of focus for us. Our goal is to accelerate scientific discovery, and that means making these steps as fast as possible, making it as easy as possible to search broad swaths of chemical or material space. But there's another part that we touched on earlier that I think is really important here. It's not sufficient to just make faster tools. We have to make those faster tools usable. And so our goal in making the platform, the Elements platform, and our goal in investing in Copilot is to open doors for other material scientists, maybe ones without computational in front of their name,
100%.
To be able to use these tools, right? In order to accelerate scientific discovery, we can't just be making better tools for the small group of folks who know and love computation. We need to be making tools for all material science. And that's our vision for the platform. That's what's coming in the future.
What a time to be in material science. More tools, easier to use, a more open world, more open data. This is just exciting. Guys, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. I just can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be on here.
Thank you.
The episode you've been listening to is sponsored by Microsoft Azure. I think it was a really neat episode, and it's cool to see a big company like Microsoft developing tools to help us discover new materials at a faster rate. I especially enjoyed seeing that they not only spent the time to set up this toolset, but also used it to find a new material and take it through fabrication and characterization. Thank you as always for listening to this episode of the Materialism Podcast. If you have questions or feedback, you can send us emails at materialism.podcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we actually love reading those. I love reading messages from fans. And also, if you would do us a huge favor, subscribe to our show. You can find us on iTunes, on Spotify. We used to be on Google Play, but it is now on YouTube. So if you look up Taylor Sparks on YouTube, you'll find them on YouTube as well there. If you leave us a review, we think that will help other people find our content, and that would be pretty rad. And then finally, you can check us out on Instagram. We have the @materialism.podcast page. You can connect with us there, leave a comment. We post lots of behind-the-scenes stuff and videos and pictures. We think you'd like it.
And lastly, we'd like to give a shout-out to Alphabot and Colabyte for making the music for the podcast. They both make a ton of really cool synthwave music, and you can check them out on Spotify and YouTube. Catch you next time.
The adventures of fire, electricity, magnetism, iron, lead, glass, silk, cotton. The makers of tools, the captors of lightning, the architect, the engineer, the musician are all beneficiaries of the materials of this world and are bound only by their imaginations in manipulating those materials.